Hello, folks, and welcome to this, another episode of Socratic Citizen. I'm Patrick Cunningham, and it is Wednesday, December 16th, the year of our Lord, 2020. Well, folks, I am, for lack of a better word, in a tizzy. My hackles are up. I have discovered a conspiracy of monumental proportions. Okay, nothing quite so dramatic. I've just noticed something that's been going on, and it was pointed out in the prison system, but it doesn't just go on there. It goes on all over the place, pretty much anywhere that anyone is anybody. And so, you know, I wanted to talk about it and point it out, but it is rather infuriating. But of course, before we get to the infuriating stuff, we got to talk about the interesting, hilarious stories, or just the kind of update of what's going on in the world. But before we do that, we have to read some comments from YouTube and do right by our loyal listeners and viewers. So yesterday I talked about Trump wanting to pardon himself because he is a stable genius, and that's what stable geniuses do. So, I'm just kidding. He does. The Office of Legal Counsel has perhaps been talking. There have been hints. There have been rumors that maybe Trump wants to pardon himself. He did not come out and say anything. And a lot of people are looking at, you know, the Attorney General of New York has been going after him. I know a judge just ruled that he's got to hand over more documents to the New York Attorney General. And so there was the possibility that he might consider pardoning himself. But Dan Stewart is back, one of our most loyal viewers. And normally he writes essays, but I guess today he had other stuff to do. And I point out two comments here. The first is, he says, back in the good old days, the party out of office called itself the Loyal Opposition. In reference, I believe, to my point that this prosecution is primarily political. Now, I'm perhaps younger than Dan. I don't know how old he is exactly, but the Loyal Opposition, I guess that means we oppose you, but we're still all Americans. You know, it would be nice if we could all just have like a national hug once a year, maybe. Maybe not this year. That might be bad policy in the COVID era. But then he says the difference would be New York Attorney General Letitia James prosecuting state income tax as opposed to the IRS enforcing federal income tax. Now, as far as I understand it, the case that Letitia James is pursuing is specifically related to former Trump lawyer turned great Trump enemy Michael Cohen, who has said publicly that Trump intentionally and artificially inflated the prices of his properties so that he could claim more money from the IRS. I am not a tax attorney, so please do not come to me for tax advice. But as far as I understand it, that's what's going on, and that is what Letitia James is going after, which I suppose could be a violation of both state and federal law, but we'll have to see what happens. This may go absolutely nowhere, or Trump may end up in prison, which I don't think would be quite the win that the establishment and the left thinks that it would be. I think that you really would start to see the populist conservative movement really increasingly start to see itself as separate from the rest of America. And this is going to come back and be important again when we get to the end of this episode and we talk about what's going on with some other companies. I don't want to give it away. It's too good. All right, so we'll get there. But next comment, this comes from Eric Barnard, and it is on my video, What Real Conservatives Really Want, from yesterday, about how real conservatives, I am inclined to agree that direct payments are the best form of COVID relief, that indeed handing out money to Walmart, and by the way, not just Walmart, but also Joel Osteen's Lakewood Church, received a $4.4 million PPP loan. Clearly, Joel Osteen did not receive back tenfold the contributions he made to God, and he chose to ask the government for money instead of asking God to give it to him. So think what you want about Joel Osteen. But the idea here is that real conservatives agree that giving money to Joel Osteen is not the way to give people COVID relief, and that the way to do it is to give out, just give people money. Don't lend money to big businesses. Don't give it to Wall Street in fees. Chase Bank collected $1 billion in fees off the CARES Act. That's who really needed money, right? Was Chase Bank. But anyway, on that video, Eric Barnard, another loyal commenter, left me this mysterious link with no context, which normally means that it's porn or someone trying to sell me something, but I took the plunge and I clicked on it, and it's from the Sacramento Bee, and it says, "Recall Governor Gavin Newsom, here's why it's a fool's errand during a COVID-19 pandemic." Essentially making the argument that this is like an emergency time, and trying to recall a leader or a governor during an emergency time, that's like trying to impeach FDR the day before D-Day. You know, it's just not a good idea. We can look back afterwards, after the pandemic's over with, they argue. Not they specifically argue, but the argument runs something like this in general. We can look back later and, you know, go after people who behaved poorly. So thank you for that, Eric. I think personally, I'm more inclined to just err on the side of people over the government. If it's the people versus the government, I generally side with the people over the government. And I mean regular individual people, small business over big business every time. So, I mean, the Sacramento Bee, maybe, maybe not. We'll have to see what happens with Gavin Newsom. It may go nowhere. They've only got 800,000 signatures out of 40 million people in California. So I'm not even sure that this is more than just a flash in the pan. You know, like you see those articles and it's like, oh, lawmaker proposes so-and-so, but the article is written in such a way that it sounds like, oh, this is the way we're going to do things now. And you got to get to paragraph 7 before they explain that, no, this is not like a new law. This is just something somebody suggested. And the recall of Governor Gavin Newsom is of exactly that character. It's something somebody suggested. So we can take that of, it's only of middling seriousness at this point. So that brings us to the end of our comments. You can, of course, if you're confused as to what's going on, find our archive on YouTube, if you're watching this on Twitch or DLive, and we post clips from the show of the most interesting things that I say. And we encourage you to leave comments. We will read the most interesting ones on the show and discuss whether or not they are in the realm of reality. So let's talk about a couple random things that are going on in the world, some of which are related to the big topic that is blowing my mind, that is absolutely stunning in its implications. But the Independent reports that Twitter confirms Trump can be banned from Inauguration Day onwards. And so this article, so a lot of people have wondered why Twitter doesn't just kick Donald Trump off. After all of the flags they have put on his tweets after Election Day, the amount of flagging of his tweets increased like 8,000%. And yes, I am making up that number, but if you are on Twitter, you know what I'm talking about. And so a lot of people say, look, just kick him off already. I'm not inclined to agree with that. I mean, I'm inclined to agree with Twitter's reasoning, at least insofar as Trump being the president, you can't just kick him off of Twitter. I'd leave him on Twitter. I mean, he's still a public figure, but apparently Twitter's spokespeople have been saying once Trump is no longer in office, once he becomes a private citizen on January 20th, 2021, because that is going to happen, Trump lunatics, there's not going to be a revolution. If you try to start revolutioning, you're going to be doing it by yourself. Like, we can talk about what's wrong with Biden. We can talk about the problems. We can say he's corrupt. We can say he's a warmonger. We can say he's Mr. Deep State, whatever you want. But we should not say, oh, Trump is going to be the next president. He's not. But Twitter confirms that once he is a private citizen on January 20th, 2021, that there will be no longer any reason not to kick him off. And I can only expect that if they're saying this, that they do intend to kick him off of Twitter. So as it stands, if the people on the left in big tech and in the establishment have their way, anyone who served in the Trump administration will not get teaching jobs. They will not be able to sit on corporate boards. Donald Trump himself will be kicked off of all social media platforms and then shortly will be deposited in prison. And we should think long and hard about what will happen in Trump world if that really goes down. There is something to be said for magnanimity in victory. There is something to be said for maybe it's not a good idea to completely destroy and floor and crush Trump, as emotionally satisfying as you might want that, as you might find that. Maybe it's better to let some things go because Trump is still extremely popular. Half the country still likes him. And if you do this, you're going to reinforce all of those people in the conservative media that are increasingly saying that this, we are at cultural war, that we are in a cold civil war. And I gotta say, war is really, unless you're Raytheon, war is bad for business. And I don't mean literally business, but just war is not fun. You don't want to be in a war. We're better off to try and make peace with the Trump people. And to Trump people, we're better off to try and make peace with the left than we are to continue down the path to war. We don't, like, it's fun to do gotcha moments. It's fun to talk about how your opponents are idiots. Oh, ha ha, look at the stupid liberal media. Oh my God, libtards. But when you cross over to the point that you're going to prosecute former presidents, I mean, Bush tortured people. He started torturing people. He invented the idea that we should torture people. And Obama continued it. And there was never a whisper of prosecuting either of them. And so whatever Trump, you imagine Trump has done, I know it's not as bad as torturing people. At least by my lights, the worst possible thing a human being can do is to torture someone. Like, murder, to me, is less bad than torturing. So maybe I'm alone in that. But if you are at all inclined to agree, then whatever standards we hold Trump to, we should hold all presidents to. And whatever crimes Trump has committed, torturing people is worse. So if Trump should be prosecuted for anything, it would be the extent to which he allowed torture programs to continue. And that means that Obama and Bush are also up for being prosecuted. But I don't hear anybody talking about that. So maybe I am alone in this. But anyway, Trump is not the only thing I want to talk about today, because House Republicans are at it again. Yes, our favorite political party. They proclaim themselves the party of the working class. And you know what they're going to do to fight for the working class against evil big tech? They're going to have another hearing, damn it. Yes, House Republicans demand another hearing on big tech's censorship of Hunter Biden stories. I don't know how closely you've been following the news, but as far as I can tell, we have about one of these per month, and nothing ever happens, and Mark Zuckerberg shows up and talks like a robot, and Jack Dorsey shows up and sounds like a hippie, and we all make fun of them. And we all rub our hands together and talk about how deeply satisfying it's going to be when big tech finally gets its comeuppance and Theodore Roosevelt rises from his grave, not to vote for Joe Biden, but in fact to whip out the Sherman Antitrust Act and go after the corporate oligopoly. But as far as I can tell, none of that is in the offing, because we've had hearing after hearing after hearing, and I doubt that Republicans, who are a majority in the Senate and still did nothing, are going to do even less than nothing as a minority in the House. So our best hope, I think, is probably the infamous Letitia James, who is going after Facebook for anti-competitive practices, and the Department of Justice going after Google for anti-competitive practices. It is not speech, but rather money that will ultimately save us from the increasingly monopolistic behavior of big tech. But as we will see at the end of this episode when we do the big story, it won't be enough. So, of course, power does as power can. And in this case, Andrew Cuomo has just been winning, winning, winning. Yes, he is Trump-style winning. The man can do no wrong. Despite the fact that he required nursing homes to take COVID-positive patients, despite the fact that those far smarter than I, far more epidemiological than I, have argued that this was indeed one of the great contributing factors to the terrible COVID numbers in New York. He was given an Emmy. He's under consideration to be Attorney General by Joe Biden. Accusations of his sexual harassment of his employees have gone completely unmentioned in the mainstream media, and now, very full of himself and ready to take on the world, he has banned the sale of Confederate flags on public property. Stay with me here. All right, this is not about how Confederate flags are awesome. I am not on that particular train, but let's listen to what actually goes on in this article. This is from the New York Post, because no episode of mine is complete without a New York Post story complaining about Andrew Cuomo. So Governor Andrew Cuomo signed a bill into law aimed at banning the sale of, quote, hate symbols, such as the Confederate flag or the swastika, on state property. Even while admitting the new edict might clash with the First Amendment and be struck down as unconstitutional. The new law, effective immediately, prohibits the sale of hate symbols on public grounds, including state and local fairs, and also severely limits their display unless deemed relevant to serving an educational or historical purpose. Now, a quick break. This is not something that's happening in isolation. I know I kind of pitched it as Andrew Cuomo is on fire. He's, you know, pedaling full speed downhill on a bike with no brakes. But there's more to the story, as usual. Because as I recently learned, Amazon in the United Kingdom will no longer sell you copies of Mein Kampf. That, yes, Hitler's autobiography slash manifesto can no longer be purchased through Amazon in the United Kingdom. Because, of course, you know, it propagates hate and so on and so forth. And that includes a number of other Nazi books. A lot of people, the guy I actually heard about this from was a YouTuber who's like a history professor. And he talked about how these things really, they have historical value. And I would go so far as to argue that they have also political value, that you need those in, like, I wouldn't ban Mein Kampf. I'd put it everywhere. Let everyone read it. You know why? Because Mein Kampf is really, really good for people who hate Nazism, for anti-fascist people. You know why? Because Mein Kampf is like the Nazi book. And I tried to read Mein Kampf. I tried to read it twice because I wanted to know what was in it. And it reads like, you know, those, remember a couple years ago when it seemed like every week there was a school shooting and the kid would always leave behind some kind of manifesto before he went and offed 40 kids at a school and then shot himself in the head and, you know, it'd be buried somewhere on 8chan. Well, I also went and read some of those because I wanted to know what drives a person to do something like this. And what I found was that they're inevitably error-filled, ungrammatical, illogical, hate-filled, frankly, nonsense. They don't make any sense. I guess I thought maybe I'd find some kid who was like a secret genius and, I don't know, the next Ted Kaczynski or something. But no, they're not secret geniuses. They're just angry and confused. Generally, there's some drug use in there. But Mein Kampf reads pretty much like a 1,500-page version of one of those school shooter manifestos. It is horrifying to read, and it makes no sense. So that is goes to show, I think, that banning hate stuff is really not always the best idea. That indeed, seeing a Confederate flag can, for example, precipitate a frank conversation about what actually went on in American history. If we wipe away our history, if we wipe away the fact that once upon a time, the southern states seceded from the Union and went to war with the northern half of the Union because they wanted to preserve the institution of slavery or because they wanted states' rights. I don't know. I'm not here to argue that particular, that's a very complicated argument. Let's just say for the time being, some guys wanted to have slaves. Some others said it was not such a swell plan, and they went to war over it. And ultimately the Union won. And then there's this whole thing about Reconstruction and how, you know, we had huge numbers of black people elected to state legislatures right afterwards. And then the South kind of took power back. The Southern Democrats took power back and reinstituted like de facto segregation, de facto slavery in the form of sharecropping. That's an important conversation to have. We need to know about that. Like future generations need to know what went on. Because those who do not remember history are doomed to repeat it. Or at the very least, as Mark Twain said, history does not repeat itself, but it does rhyme. And it's interesting to note that I think there was a study done recently that said something like 25% of school age high school kids today don't know what Auschwitz is. If you are one such person, then Auschwitz was a very bad place. And I recommend you read Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning if you want to get a good idea of what it was like to exist in Auschwitz. And it's what happens when you let hatred of a group of people like cloud your ability to reason and have that kind of milk of human kindness that exists by default in the human heart and is extended by default to other human beings that you encounter. But the other side of this is that Cuomo actually knows that this is a First Amendment problem, because the United States has done one thing very right, and that is to stand with an almost absolutist commitment to free expression. And as I've said before, free expression is the necessary precursor to all true philosophical thought. Any pursuit of truth must take place in a free environment, because the state's monopoly on violence requires that the state reserve one little kind of piece of the philosophical world and say, there's a chance we might be wrong about the things we enforce. There's a chance that we might be wrong. And therefore, if somebody can come along and show that we're wrong, there has to be a way for them to change and influence the system. Because if the state is using violence and the state is wrong, then their monopoly on violence is illegitimate. And then the state just becomes a gangster. But Cuomo knows this. He knows it violates the First Amendment, what he's doing. And he says, oh, you know, it might need certain technical changes so we don't get caught up on free speech protections codified in the First Amendment. So here's his reasoning. This country faces a pervasive and growing attitude of intolerance and hate, what I have referred to in the body politic as an American cancer, Cuomo wrote in his approval message. By limiting the display and sale of the Confederate flag, Nazi swastika, and other symbols of hatred from being displayed or sold on state property, including the state fairgrounds, this will help safeguard New Yorkers from the fear-installing effects of those abhorrent symbols. But this is a blatant violation of the First Amendment. Indeed, if you amend the bill to take out the parts that violate the First Amendment, you will be left with a blank sheet of paper. Which I'm sure that if Cuomo got a blank sheet of paper passed, he would no doubt be applauded by those who seem ready to applaud him for just about everything. But this attitude of censoriousness, this attitude of using any little bit of power I might have to control to the greatest extent possible every little decision made by the people around me, which, as I'll argue elsewhere later and have argued elsewhere previously, is a product of a lack of trust between people in the society. You can have a high trust society or you can have an authoritarian society. Generally, you do not have both, and you cannot have neither. Having neither is just anarchy, chaos, and it inevitably leads to either authoritarianism or some kind of rebirth of the high trust society. And I think you know which one of those is generally more likely to happen. So with that in mind, Fox News reports that Pelosi will require House members to wear masks to be recognized. In other words, if you are a member of the House, if you are, for example, a Republican who wants to have the 87th big tech hearing this year, you have to call for it with your mask on. And if you take your mask off to talk, then Pelosi will take away your recognition and you will no longer be allowed to speak. Those who are inclined to favor lockdowns and, you know, more authority when it comes to dealing with COVID will be inclined, of course, to applaud this, but I'm more inclined to look at this, which is from Undark, the kind of scientific, quasi-scientific magazine. It says, pandemic shaming can backfire. Here's a better way. And the article talks about how, well, I'll just read the first paragraph here. With the holiday season continuing and the spread of COVID-19 widely expected to worsen, many of us face the same gut-wrenching decision. To gather or not to gather? Do we take comfort in familiar rituals with family and friends, or should we limit celebrations to the relative isolation of our COVID-19 bubbles? The safest strategy, unquestionably, is to abstain from festivities with those outside of our immediate households. But not everyone values safety more than social connection. This is very smart right here, and I think I wish more people recognized this fact when we're like, oh, you just want grandma to die because someone doesn't want to live by COVID restrictions. What you're looking at is a difference of values. You know, some people value adventure more. Some people value safety more. Some people like chaos. Some people like order. Some people like safety. Some people like social connection and will take social connection at the risk of safety. But public shaming and blanket demands for abstinence can backfire. Those who taught sex ed classes in the 1970s can no doubt attest to the truth and wisdom inherent in that statement. That telling kids, oh, just don't have sex, doesn't really work. So instead, the author here advocates for harm reduction. Look, it's better if you just wait till marriage to have sex, but if you're gonna do it, then use a condom. If you're gonna do it, be aware of the prevalence of STDs, right? So the idea emerged during the AIDS crisis, and it actually talks about needle exchanges. It talks about the way that needle exchanges were used as a way to slow the spread of AIDS and hepatitis and all sorts of other needle-based diseases. And they say that perhaps that approach, the approach of saying, look, I realize you guys are going to do what you're going to do. So if you could, which you don't mind, just do these one or two things just so we don't cause huge problems in the world with you doing what you want to do. And ultimately, that works better because A, people are going to do what they're going to do. And if you try to shut it down completely, you just create black markets. You create underground communities of people who are going to do what they're going to do. And those communities, because you've completely lost all legitimacy by demanding something that no one's going to actually do, they see no reason to listen to you. But if you say, look, I'm here to meet you in the middle. Okay, you're going to do what you're going to inject drugs with needles. Okay, fine. I'm not so into that idea, but if you really want to do it, then just at least do this. Just at least use a clean needle. Here, have a clean needle. And you slow the spread of disease. Because you've maintained your legitimacy as someone who can be listened to. When you're not saying something that's so far outside the person who you're talking to, it's so far outside their Overton window that they just feel there's no need to listen to you at all. You remain a reasonable person who accepts that the person you're talking to is a reasonable person. And we could use a lot more of that in American society today, because if we don't start doing that, we are on a dark, dark path. But it's not entirely crazy that we don't trust each other in this country like perhaps we used to. That perhaps the breakdown of a commonly held, commonly shared set of values has had, like, it's had practical ramifications. And some of those practical ramifications include things like this. And this is kind of the opening salvo in getting into what I wanted to talk about and the reason for the title of this episode. So David Korn writes in Mother Jones that Elizabeth Warren has issued a scathing report on corrupt prison audits. All right, and so we're going to take the broadest possible definition of media from the title of this episode and then use it to include anybody who puts out information, anybody who shares information. All right. So the organization responsible for accrediting U.S. prisons, jails, and detention centers not like accrediting colleges. It's not like, oh, well, my brother's going to prison. At least he's going to an accredited prison where he can get a proper education in being a criminal for the next 10 years. But the organization responsible for accrediting U.S. prisons, jails, and detention centers runs a corrupt process that puts a rubber stamp on dangerous facilities while taking in millions from the private prison industry, according to a scathing report from Senator Elizabeth Warren, shared with Mother Jones. So the result is, the report is the result of a 19-month investigation by the senator's office, and it examined the American Correctional Association, a non-governmental organization that acts simultaneously as a professional association and an oversight body for prison and detention systems. Federal, state, and local governments pay the ACA to audit the facilities where they keep people incarcerated and issue its stamp of approval on their operations. Qualifying facilities must meet the standards ACA spells out in its published manuals, covering everything from fire code compliance to officer gun training. Private prisons and detention centers, meanwhile, are often required to get accredited by the ACA to access lucrative government contracts, according to Warren's report. And when scrutinized, they point to their accreditation status as a defense. After all, the ACA's website says, accreditation is awarded only to the best of the best. The best of the best prisons. So the problem is that the best of the best includes, right here, virtually every facility that pays its accreditation fees. The ACA currently counts over 1,200 accredited facilities, and since 2007, only four have been denied accreditation. The group provides 3 months' notice and preparation tools for audits, essentially providing the answers to the test in advance, as the report puts it. Imagine if they treated restaurants this way, if the local health department treated restaurants this way, but they do not. They show up, they give surprise visits, and I would imagine that practices in prisons would change if indeed there were surprise visits. But we should not be surprised by this. In fact, if you told me a week ago, before I had ever heard of this, that there was a private organization that accredits prisons so that they can get money from the federal government and house prisoners, I would say it probably works like this. It's probably one of those things where if you pony up the money, then you get the accreditation, and basically it's kind of a whole big con where the accreditation says, look, we're selling trust. You can trust these prisons that we've accredited. And then the prisons say, we're accredited by this organization, so you can trust us. But really, it's like a dragon with no head. There's no true locus of trust. It's just everybody saying, I believe in this, and therefore it works. But then you go investigate, and you find out that there's really nothing there. That it is kind of like a cloud that only appears to be solid when you look at it from far away. Once you get up close, you realize it's just mist. But this happens all over the place. The problem is we let it fly in prisons because, you know, screw those guys. They committed crimes. They deserve that or whatever. And also, the state farming out its monopoly on violence is generally not a good idea. There's a reason we say only the state's allowed to do violence, and by violence I mean also locking people in cages. Private prisons are generally, I'm in favor of privatizing stuff in general. Not prisons. Because you can only run a private prison if you're a pretty big company. One strike against you there. Strike two, you only get money from the federal government. There's another strike against you right there. And finally, you are basically, they're basically farming out, outsourcing their monopoly on violence. Strike three, bad idea. But, and this is going to lead into the real topic I wanted to talk about. This goes to like industry awards. If you run a business, then you know what I'm talking about. You've gotten this stuff in the mail. And so Disruptive Views, which is just some random blog, has this, the best headline ever. Industry awards, wham, bam, thank you, scam. So it basically, the author points out he was recently asked to do some due diligence on an association that was giving out business excellence awards. My client was advised that they had been nominated by their industry peers and experts for the award, or at least to be considered. The catch, winning the award had a minimum $10,000 price tag. So this works the same way that the accreditation for prisons works, where if you pay up, you get the accreditation, you get the award, and you get to put it on your wall and put it in your brochures, and the prison gets to go to the state government or the federal government and say, hey, look, we're accredited. Therefore, we're the best of the best. We've won a prison excellence award. But there is another place that this happens, and it is in academia. And now I'm not saying that the university system is completely illegitimate, at least not yet. What I am saying is that there are college accreditation scams, as academia.org reports here. So parents and students who breathe a sigh of relief because the college of their choice is accredited may want to wait to exhale. That makes more sense. The main reason for this failure is that the system relies too heavily on colleges to self-regulate. So these authors here write in a paper for the Center for College Affordability and Productivity. For example, 83% of the board for Middle States Commission on Higher Education is comprised of people that work for the institutions that they then accredit. I wonder how many people who work for the American Correctional Association are either present prison employees or owners or stockholders or will in the future be employees or employers or stockholders. I'd be willing to bet there's quite a few. And that brings me to the real thing that I wanted to talk about, the reason for the title of this episode, which is Media Mafia. And it involves, so let's start here to give a little bit of kind of the background. And this is from Quillette, Journalism's Ivory Towers. In a recent essay entitled The Resentment That Never Sleeps, New York Times columnist Thomas Edsel explains how a lowering of social status among non-college educated white Americans has increased that demographic's anxiety. Full Figured says it is a mafia, but it sure as hell isn't Italian. Well, Full Figured, I'm guessing you missed the part where we were talking about Andrew Cuomo, who definitely is Italian and is right now very much benefiting Frank Sinatra style from the favor of the mafia. But what we're here to actually talk about is the particular racket that this particular mafia is running. So stick around. We're going to make it all make sense. So Americans have a loss of social status among non-college educated white Americans has increased that demographic's anxiety and helped fuel the populism that made possible Donald Trump's rise to the presidency. See, according to the elite, the only thing that can possibly motivate populism is resentment. Oh, you're just mad. But anyway, reporters at many of America's most prestigious journalistic outlets have echoed these sentiments. But none of the reporters ever seems willing to acknowledge their own complicity in the situation. Plenty of jobs that once used to require no university degree or special certification now do. So the number of American jobs requiring state certification has risen from 1 in 20, 60 years ago, to 1 in 4 today. And here's the key. This is the good part. Technically, journalists do not require a university degree in order to practice their trade. Practically speaking, however, they do. No one who writes for the New York Times, the Atlantic, the New Yorker, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, or any other major U.S. journalistic venue lacks a college degree. In fact, to write for one of those publications, you'd better make sure that your university degree comes from a highly prestigious institution. The New York Times has more regular op-ed columnists who are transgender than those who lack a college degree. Transgender people make up anywhere from 0.6 to 5% of the U.S. population, whereas 36% of Americans have a college degree. So roughly two-thirds of the Americans you see on the street will probably lack a college degree, but walk into the offices of a prestigious newspaper or magazine and you'll find almost no one other than the janitors and possibly the receptionist from this cohort. So as long as we're talking about accreditation scams and a media mafia, let's take a look at what they're actually learning in some of these institutions of higher education here, with higher and education both in quotation marks. Simmons University Library has this anti-oppression, anti-fatmesia piece here explaining what's wrong with fat shaming, with a quote in this lovely chalkboard font, says the word fat is not inherently bad. Yes, for example, when you receive a fat check from the state, it is a benign descriptor of size. The only negativity the word carries is that which has been socially constructed around it. Our aversion is completely learned. So, fatmesia, I don't know why they didn't say fat phobia. I read somewhere in the explaining this that I guess they said, well, people have legitimate phobias. Full Figured says that was a total lie. I'm guessing you're referring to the lovely stuff here on the chalkboard. Yeah, we're going to talk about how it's not learned. But just check this out. So these are the three incorrect cultural assumptions that, according to Simmons University, prove that fatmesia is made up. These are the incorrect assumptions. It's incorrect to assume that there is, within minimal physical divergence, a right or normal body type, and it is a thin one. There is an automatic correlation between thinness and physical health, and in turn, that health is an indicator of value. That fatness or a fat body type is abnormal, and therefore a social disadvantage and or a health risk. So, I guess what they're trying to tell us is that it's okay to be fat, and we're going to not talk about how fat people are more at risk for type 2 diabetes, more at risk for heart disease, more at risk to die of COVID, by the way. So that's what we're learning at Simmons University. Moving on, we have Inside Higher Ed. This author talks about what students don't know about student activities, mostly benign, but then he gets to the part, this professor here is researching on university campuses, how extracurricular activities are, what's the phrase they love to use, a performative rearticulation of privileging and marginalizing worldviews and social constructs that give all the privilege to white men and make sure no one else gets to have anything good. So one of the findings, this is from an interview, and the question the interviewer asks is, why are white men most likely to find success in extracurriculars? Well, one of the findings unearthed is that white men frequently have an easier time acquiring a durable sense of belonging in extracurricular outlets than their peers who identify as women or racial and ethnic minority students. In the extracurricular settings I observed, white men were able to draw from race and gendered assumptions about authority to take on styles of self-presentation that positioned them as group leaders or intellectuals. In the process, they became central and highly valued members of these groups, and the perception that they were appreciated by peers cultivated feelings of belonging. So I guess the argument is that if you are black, or you identify as a woman, or if you are a native, indigenous, tribal, Inuit, or whatever, that you should not expect to become, regardless of what you do, a central or highly valued member of an extracurricular group. And you will not cultivate feelings of belonging because you will not have the perception that you are appreciated by your peers. So that's something else we're learning in the colleges that you have to go to work at the major media organizations. A little bit more, I got the great idea to go look at campus reform. And so the University of Utah hosts a Wellness Beyond Whiteness health fair. This is their yearly health fair that they hold every year, but this year it's about wellness beyond whiteness, whatever that means. Maybe that's like wellness beyond fatness, where it's like just because you're fat and white does not mean that you are unhealthy. Does it mean that you are not necessarily racist? I don't know. And then finally, we have the motherlode. Math education professor, the two plus two equals four trope reeks of white supremacy patriarchy. Mathematics is racist. They asserted that the statement 2 + 2 = 4 is rooted in Western definitions of mathematics. Math professors and academics at top universities, including Harvard and the University of Illinois, discussed the Eurocentric roots of American mathematics on Twitter. And finally, of course, Abraham Lincoln, once a hero, is now a bad guy in some San Francisco education circles from the San Francisco Chronicle. Abraham Lincoln High School in San Francisco is having its name changed because Abraham Lincoln did not do enough to demonstrate that black lives mattered to him. Abraham Lincoln. I remember when we were tearing down Robert E. Lee because he fought on behalf of the Confederacy. And I was kind of iffy. I'm like, oh, maybe this is okay. I get it. It's offensive to people. But now we've moved on to Abraham Lincoln. I even understood when it was Thomas Jefferson. Not that I agreed. I love Thomas Jefferson. But I understand people went, oh, he owned slaves. How could he talk about the equality of all men and still have slaves? And he was apparently doing some untoward things with that Sally Hemings. But Abraham Lincoln didn't own any slaves. Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves. Abraham Lincoln was supposed to be like the hero. He's supposed to be like the example that we're supposed to live up to. But no, we cannot have his name on schools because that might trigger some people who I cannot imagine why. So I bring all of this up because I did promise to draw this all back and make the connection between media and mafia. So what we've seen so far is there are these systems where I set up and I say, hi, I'm the accreditation system. And anyone I give my seal of approval to is accredited and you can trust them because I am trustworthy because I'm an accreditation institution. And we saw how it works in prisons. We saw how it works with these business excellence awards. And we saw the accreditation scams where colleges will create these kind of fake colleges. Or really terrible for-profit colleges will create fake accreditation institutions, which then turn around and give them accreditation so they can tell the parents of the students who want to go there, hey, look, we're accredited. And then I drew that a little further to say our actual regular university system is kind of turning into this because it says, oh, you have a bachelor's degree in whatever, journalism. Now you can go work at the New York Times because you are trusted and intelligent. But what they're actually learning is that being fat is good, that extracurriculars are only for white people, and that health, and Abraham Lincoln was one of history's villains. So that brings me to what the media mafia actually does. And it's the same system, but it works in reverse. So if you are accredited and you work in that media mafia, the media mafia will go and find institutions that put out material with which they disagree because they currently rely on their monopoly, right? They basically, the legacy media, have what amounts to a monopoly on information. I know there's the internet and you're watching this show right now and I'm basically the best alternative available, but they have an effective monopoly and they do their best to hold on to that monopoly. Which is why if you go and type any news stories, keywords, into YouTube, the first 10 pages, 5 pages, even maybe the first page are ABC, NBC, CNN, so on and so forth. Because they are trying to preserve their monopoly. That's why people at the New York Times say nasty things about the right to free speech, about the First Amendment. Because we, the unwashed masses, the hoi polloi, we tend to use free speech to like say stuff that we want to talk about. And that makes them very mad because we should only talk about what they want to talk about. But if you go too far, then organizations, reverse accreditation organizations, like, for example, the Southern Poverty Law Center, will put you on their list, not of trusted people, but of hateful people. And instead of everyone knowing that you can then receive government money, you can then no longer receive money, in fact, from anyone, as this article from LifeSite News points out. This is actually from 2012, but I have a couple of others that are from a more recent epoch. Visa and MasterCard cut off all credit card donations to us, says a United States conservative organization. Or no, 2018, I'm sorry, not 2012. So the David Horowitz Freedom Center is the latest conservative organization to be targeted by online services' intensifying censorship campaign. Led by prominent conservative author and speaker David Horowitz, the Freedom Center is dedicated to combating the, quote, efforts of the radical left and its Islamist allies to destroy American values and disarm this country through a wide variety of websites, publications, resources, and events. Now, before anybody goes crazy and starts tearing out my hair, I will say that yes, David Horowitz is a rather anti-Islamic fellow, and his friends are all rather anti-Islamic fellows. I personally am rather sympathetic to Islam. I don't really take it's a religion of violence to be exactly a strike against it, considering that, you know, you go back 500 years, Christianity is kind of a religion of violence sometimes too. That's neither here nor there. Point being, I'm not like super on board with whatever it is that David Horowitz is saying this week. I am on board, however, with Visa and MasterCard should not be doing this. They should not be cutting off credit card donations to the Freedom Center. Now we cannot process donations from any major credit card companies, Horowitz wrote, blaming the left-wing Southern Poverty Law Center for pressuring the companies. And Full Figured says this is critical race theory employed in all white countries with the goal of demoralization of all white populations and empowerment of non-whites. Critical theory means that a person can deconstruct any concept and existence and interpret the individual parts or the newly assembled whole for their personal political goals. This is character assassination of white people on a worldwide scale, with the further goal of physical annihilation. I've certainly heard that argument before, Full Figured. However, I am what you might call a racial skeptic, meaning I don't think that race is the primary motivating factor, and that the fact that it seems that you can construct this argument and you can say, oh, it's all about white people, I would say it has more to do with culture than with race. But in general, you're right about what critical race theory is. A person can deconstruct any concept in existence and interpret the individual parts or newly assembled whole for their personal political goals. Really, it's like, oh, we have this concept of justice. Really, critical race theorists, or critical theorists, not critical race theorists, critical theorists would say, and this is like an old Marxist thing, the whole concept of justice is just there to keep the powerful in power. Okay, that part I agree with you. Character assassination on a worldwide scale. Yes, I would say it's character assassination of people of a nationalist bent, people of a traditionalist bent, anybody who isn't on board with a kind of like neo-feudalist global transhuman future. And those people can be of any race. I would go so far as to say, Full Figured, that they're just as interested in shutting up Larry Elder as they are in shutting up any white person. Although Larry Elder is a more mocha shade. So the only part I disagree with you on really is the white people thing. I don't think it's about white people specifically. I think it's about a particular culture. But the mechanism by which it works is nonetheless true, and it's nonetheless there. So this blow, David Horowitz says, could be the end of the Freedom Center. Decades of work down the drain because the hateful left wants to squash free speech and silence an organization that dares to question them. Now, I have to disagree a little bit with David Horowitz here, because I don't think it's just the left. Indeed, the left has, at once or twice, been on the receiving end of this. As I've pointed out many times before, the socialist magazine Jacobin and Mother Jones, a leftist rag we were reading from here earlier and that I actually frequently enjoy reading, Except when they get all Trump derangement. They're not fun at that point. But both of them have reported that Facebook has reduced distribution of their articles in the past. Anything anti-imperialist, for example, is going to have its distribution reduced. Much like the Daily Wire on the right has had their distribution reduced. Or at least Shapiro claims they have. I don't know. He still seems to be, like, winning on Facebook in a pretty big way. Maybe he just likes the idea that he can go out and claim, they're censoring me! Like a badge of honor in the conservative movement. If nobody's censoring you, you ain't doing anything right. But anyway, it's more about protecting a particular strain of thought. And that strain of thought is the strain of thought that loves Joe Biden, which many on the left do not love Joe Biden. Joe Biden is packing his administration with establishment Democrats, Rahm Emanuels, Neera Tandons, and Austin Lloyds. Not exactly leftists, not far leftists. Far leftists are very unhappy with Biden. Far leftists are being pushed out of the conversation, just like conservatives are. Because as I argued here when I was talking with Full Figured, it's really not about any one particular race or even a particular ideology. It's about protecting one particular strain that keeps the people who are in power in power. And that brings us, of course, to other instances of this same sort of thing. Now, this one is from 2012. I probably should have read this one first. But PayPal has instituted, this is from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, one of my favorite publications of all time. They are awesome. PayPal has instituted a new policy aimed at censoring what digital denizens can and can't read. And they're doing it in a way that leaves us with little recourse to challenge their policies in court. Indie publisher Smashwords has notified contributing authors, etc., they'll no longer be providing a platform for certain forms of sexually explicit fiction. So PayPal shut them down because they didn't like the kind of fiction they were publishing. They said, oh, you publish rape fiction. You publish, here it is, bestiality, rape for titillation, incest, and underage erotica, which, of course, reasonable people might agree or disagree about the value or even moral rightness of people writing about these sorts of things. I myself am in no way a fan of any of these particular genres, but we're not really here to talk about the genres. We're here to talk about the fact that payment processors have entered a new line of business, and that new line of business is going after people whose views they don't like. It was not so long ago that you could argue in all seriousness and say, well, look, Facebook and Twitter need to stop censoring people all the time. They need to act like the phone company or the credit card company. You know, they just put your payment through. They don't pay attention to who you are. Perhaps we should have seen in our infinite hubris that the grand law of irony would eventually come to smack us in the ass, and that indeed this is only the precursor to AT&T and T-Mobile deciding what phone calls you're allowed to make. If you're making phone calls to propagate hate or talk about how much you love bestiality and rape for titillation and incest, then we're just not going to carry you anymore. And that brings us to the big article, the biggest thing going on, I think, today. Visa and MasterCard have cut all ties with Pornhub. Yes, everyone's favorite pornography purveyor, the drug dealer of naked people of all shapes and sizes, Pornhub is removing millions of user-uploaded videos. This action comes after a New York Times column accused the website of hosting sexual videos of underage and non-consenting women. In response to the Times article, Visa and MasterCard cut ties with Pornhub, making it impossible for Pornhub to process payments other than through cryptocurrencies. This isn't a debate. This is why I love this magazine right here. This isn't a debate over whether Pornhub is predatory. Everyone agrees that putting up child porn is bad. That if you put up child porn, you should indeed be prosecuted. And even if you are prosecuted and put in prison, even the dirty, rotten criminals will continue to, well, not prosecute you, but persecute you. You will, as a child pornographer, have about the worst time in prison that a person can have. That might be the group with the highest suicide rate in human history. Child pornographers and child molesters in prisons. So, we're all agreed on that. No one is on board with child pornography. No one is on board with abusing children. And no one is on board, at least no one speaking seriously who's not a college frat boy, is on board with the idea of, like, drugging women and then filming people having sex with them. All of this stuff is evil and bad, and I'm just as on board as I think everybody watching this is, that if somebody does that, then we should really go after them. That there's a good time for the state's monopoly on violence to be unleashed on a particular individual. The problem here is Visa and MasterCard usurping the sacred responsibility of law enforcement to go after not the people who put up the material, the people who hosted the material. And this, weirdly, goes back to Section 230. Those Nerdy Metal Guys says, perhaps it's time for conservatives to embrace the lessons of cancel culture. Cease using PayPal, Visa, MasterCard. Decide if your values outweigh convenience. Nerdy Metal Guys, I am very upset with you. Because I had this whole dramatic lead-up planned that was going to end with me saying exactly that, and you've stolen my thunder. But it's probably for the best, because I was prepared to talk for another 45 minutes and rant and rave about this, but we're coming to the end of our hour here, and as I've said before, I still have a day job. So I have to bring this to a close here in just a second, but those Nerdy Metal Guys is right. Perhaps it's time for conservatives to embrace the lessons of cancel culture. Cease using PayPal, Visa, and MasterCard. Now, that is not easy. Because Visa and MasterCard are everywhere. I, in looking at this article, whipped out my debit card. And what? Lo and behold, it says Visa on it. I would show it to you, but I'm not an idiot. So that's going to be hard to get out from under. So those Nerdy Metal Guys, I would encourage you, if you have good ways for people to stop using these things, other than like, oh, I'm going to just buy everything with Bitcoin, because unfortunately most of us are not internationally renowned hackers and or guys who appear on YouTube talking about how he bought a Lamborghini with Bitcoin. We have to figure out what the actual mechanics of doing this are, because I don't know about you guys, but I got completely blindsided by this. It never occurred to me that Visa and MasterCard would start going after people's politics. The first I ever heard about it was Andrew Torba from Gab claims that he personally has been blacklisted by Visa. And yet Gab continues to collect donations. I don't know how they do it because I didn't look. I kind of thought, oh, Andrew Torba, he's out there. He's a lunatic. In the best possible way. Love Andrew Torba. Totally support what he's doing. But, you know, a guy who's going to start Gab and keep that going. If you guys have been on Gab, you know what I'm talking about. He's got to be pretty out there. But I just want to say, does anybody remember when Alex Jones got kicked off of everything? Does anybody remember when they said, oh, no. Alex Jones deserves it. Alex Jones is harassing the parents of children who were killed in mass shootings. Their child dies in a mass shooting. The last thing in the world that they want is to have this rotund, screaming, insane maniac chasing them down to demand to know why it is that they serve the evil child molesting cabal of the deep state. And they kicked him off. And most of us said, okay, fine. He deserves it. First, they go after this. First, they go, oh, they're abusing children. Oh, my God, they're hosting child pornography. We have to shut them down. And everybody says, oh, my God, okay, yeah, fine. I had a friend who said that. I said, hey, you know, Pornhub cut ties with Visa and MasterCard. And they said, why'd you leave out the most important part of the story? It was because Pornhub was illegally, sexualizing children. I kind of went, okay, that's really not the whole story, as we've seen here, but people were mostly going, yeah, okay, fine. And then they inch in a little further. Oh, this guy's really racist. Let's cut off his credit card. Let's refuse to let them take payments. Because VDare, the anti-immigration site, they're slightly racist. And their payment processor, they reported, has cut them off. And so it inches ever inward until there comes a day, if this process is left unchecked, if nobody follows the advice of those Nerdy Metal Guys, and we just let this go, eventually it reaches a point where unless you toe the official line, you won't be able to take payments. And we will live in the world like the one described by Bill Burr, the comedian, several years ago, where he's hanging out with his friends and somebody's chip gets turned off and he's outside shaking his fist at the satellite yelling, "Turn it back on!" And everybody's going, "I'm not going near him, they're going to turn my chip off." So we have a serious, we have a serious problem to deal with here. Those Nerdy Metal guys says it will be uncomfortable, it equates to using cash, buying locally and in person, and disengaging from the current mentality of comfort is king. Very stoic of you, those Nerdy Metal guys. And Full Figured said, if it was really about child porn, wouldn't they take only the child porn down and not all unverified user content? I don't know exactly what the internal mechanics of... I know Pornhub has taken down zillions of videos. If you know something I don't, that it is all unverified user content, then yeah, absolutely. But really what's going on here is Visa and MasterCard are in the process of asserting their right to dictate what you can say by choosing what customers they will do business with on the basis of either their politics or of them engaging in practices they don't like. Even if you're totally on board and Pornhub is evil and we should ban pornography. Okay, fine. That's a separate discussion. It's not Visa and MasterCard's job because there are few monopolies in the world quite as complete as Visa and MasterCard. But as I said, that does very unfortunately bring us to the end of our hour. Thank you everyone for watching and for your fascinating and enlightening and occasionally titillating comments in the chat. We will be back tomorrow at 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time for another hour of rage-inducing, hackle-raising craziness. So be sure to share this channel, this video, all of it with your friends like it's the unearned wealth of your ancestors. Come back to see us. We are here 9 to 10 Eastern Standard Time every Monday through Friday morning, and you can find our video archive on YouTube. And of course, you can, if you want to support the show, go over to our Patreon page for as long as I hold on to Patreon in light of all of this news here, and share a few of your couch shekels with us so we can get a real website and set up some payment processor that is not Visa or MasterCard to improve the level of discussion and promote quality citizen journalism for all freedom-loving peoples the world over. So, thank you very much for watching. This has been another episode of Socratic Citizen.